This is a podcast edition of Dialect Radio's weekly show. We're coming to you from Bristol City Centre, just off Queen Square, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners, wherever they are in the world. Hello and welcome to this week's Dialect Radio. The show's coming to you from Bristol City Centre, and we're part of the Bristol Radio Co-op. Hello to everyone in Bristol, and also to our listeners in Preston, and those all over the world accessing the show over the internet. We have three studio guests this week: Phil Shepp, a documentary filmmaker; Barb Drummond, an author who writes history books on local issues; and Marla from the Bristol University action group STAR, which campaigns for equal rights for asylum seekers. Our features this week are courtesy of Anthony Page and Tony Gosling. We have a song by the Shantymen of Bristol, The Singing Pirates. Malcolm Greaves reads another instalment of Hedge Trimmings by A. Street, a whimsical tale set in Wiltshire. Trevor Castle, our resident bard, is here to read his latest poem, and Jeff Sparks is back in the studio for his What's On Guide and the Song of the Week. I'm John Peters Coleman, and I'd like to introduce our first guest, Mr. Phil Shepp. Hello.
Hello.
So, you are a member of two bodies, in fact, the Somerset Film and Community Media Association. Now, tell me, which of those, you know, did you come to first as in your background as a documentary filmmaker?
I came first to Somerset Film.
Okay, tell me a little bit about that.
Somerset Film is now a registered charity which operates from Bridgewater, from a community media centre that we created there on the high street in the town, which has a studio and it has editing facilities and it has a cafe and is a resource for anyone really in Somerset and indeed beyond who wants to make films. I say make films, that's how we started, and that reflects my background and some of the other people involved, that we come from filmmaking backgrounds. But increasingly, as the technology moves on and we are more and more engaged in other forms of digital media, including a bit of radio, so people come in and they're working on all kinds of projects, you know, whether it's podcasting or web-based stuff. Whatever.
How long is your own background in documentary filmmaking?
Now we're going back a bit now. I started making films when I was about 16, on 16mm at home.
Right.
I'm now 61. And then there was a very long gap while I kind of dived off and worked in theatre and performing arts for a long time. And then I came back to it in the 80s and went to Bournemouth Film School as a mature student, and then worked at the BBC making documentaries with children's TV, and then sort of through a freelance kind of independent producer route found myself in Somerset, where I was actually born originally, and working through projects that have a bit of support locally through the local authorities, through Southwest Arts, and latterly through Southwest Screen. Really, the object was kind of, with a little bit of public money, what difference could that make to anything?
Okay, so what sort of outlet do these films with Somerset Film usually have? Where can they go once people have made their films? Who sees them?
They typically go out on the web, or they go on to DVD, and sometimes they're broadcast on, you know, we used to do things with HTV in the days when regional television was regional, as opposed to now just sort of part of a national kind of commercial chain, which it always was, but there used to be slots that you could get access to, and they're not there anymore. And mobile phones and all sorts of places that people's films get to, because it happens on kind of two levels really through Somerset Film. There's individuals and communities who've got something to say or get a message out, or they just want to make something for the pure creative fun of it, and that stuff can go in all those sorts of directions. But we also get commissioned to make quite a lot of programs, so we're kind of public service non-broadcasters and occasional broadcasters making films for anybody, from e.g. the British Institute of Learning Disabilities or MenCap or Help the Aged or...
Must be an interesting time at the moment, because just as technology is getting better, I mean, the funding might be dipping away with the recession. So how are you finding trying to organise it.
Yeah, it is a very trying. It is a testing time. You're absolutely right. And we're moving from a grant culture to a contract culture, but budgets are ever spiralling downwards at the same time. We never really had much support. We never had a lot of revenue support. We weren't like some arts organisations where they were heavily underpinned by the Arts Council or by a local authority.
So you've learned to be self-reliant. So.
Yeah, we've always had to just do it. And that's why we've built this mix of making stuff and giving people work experience and traineeships and apprenticeships that route, and using the often tiny margins from that to generate a public service on the back of it.
So how wide a catchment area do you have for Somerset Film? Is it literally just sort of within those within the county?
Somerset is our target because that's where we live and where we get a little bit of revenue support for working in Somerset. But it's a tiny percentage of our overall turnover. But we get people coming in from all over the southwest, really, and beyond. We've got a very vibrant Young People's Film Council that now has members all over the country, tell me.
So tell me a little bit about how that links in with your interest in the Community Media Association.
Well, I'm the chair of this thing called the Community Media Association, which is a national body that represents community broadcasting in the UK. Mm. And I slightly by default became chair of it, having got voted onto the National Council, because the background to the Community Media Association, otherwise known as CMA, is that it was set up originally as the Community Radio Association by radio enthusiasts, really, in the late 80s, early 90s. And that kind of grew and became a very powerful lobbying organisation around about the year 2000, 2001, and was majorly informed the Government's Communications Act of 2002,
okay,
which created a new tier of broadcasting, community broadcasting, through the Community Radio Order.
Of which BCFM is...
BCFM is a licensed station, and is it Ujima? Mm-hmm. In Bristol is also another licensed station. So those stations were enabled through the CMA.
Okay.
And I got involved in it kind of round about the same time as HTV was no longer commissioning us. We were looking for ways of getting our programmes out.
Yeah.
And it wasn't only that, but it was a sort of a happy... In fact, the CMA helped us get the money to set up our centre in Bridgewater originally through UK Online by giving us a lot of good advice at the right moment.
So this changed from the name of Community Radio Association to Community Media kind of signifies possibly a little bit more TV might possibly come in, but local sort of TV, community TV, has never really quite taken off in the same way as sort of community radio.
Well, there's never been any government support for it. I mean, I think if you go back to the days of sort of the Swindon Cable, Greenwich TV, those sorts of experiments in the 70s and 80s, I think basically government's always run scared of giving people too much voice, really. You know, they've always been scared what might happen if people had too much control of the airwaves, and quite right too, you know, because there might be some big changes.
Yeah.
Would that be a fine thing? So there's that sort of background to it, but... You're right. There is something at the moment running called United for Local Television, which combines the very few stations that have managed to sustain on air running local telly. And that's one in Belfast, Northern Visions, one in Leicester, which is an Asian station that amazingly successfully combines Bollywood movies and very local content very successfully.
Okay.
There's one called Oxford Six in Oxford. And there aren't too many others. There was one on the Isle of Wight till recently, and that folded. It's perilous existence trying to make it work.
I mean, do you think it's possibly to do with the fact that even, you know, back in the days with national telly, like Doctor Who looked ridiculously low budget in some places it was? I mean, is there a danger local TV up until now is always probably going to look a little bit shoddy?
Well, I think it depends how you do it. I mean, we had local TV in Taunton at one time in Somerset. I wasn't involved in that, but I went in there a few times and I met the people and everything. And it... I mean, you know, with the greatest respect to everyone that was involved in it, it was pretty good, really. But having said that, you know, people watched it. People loved it because it was local.
And it meant something.
And it meant something. And actually, where I think people make the mistake is that they try and emulate HTV or regional TV. Why would you want to? You know, actually, be yourselves, be different, be something else, you know. And I think the success of YouTube, I mean, not just YouTube, but... You know, the way in which media is used now, and people make movies with their phones and watch them with their friends or stream them on the net, you know, and you don't, it's not about all that kind of mid-Atlantic gloss.
So being a member of the Community Media Association, what do you kind of see being in the near future or the future for broadcasting in your role as a documentary filmmaker? Is there any which way do you think the wind is blowing?
Well, I think it's a tough call to try and get licensed telly locally. I mean, it's a kind of odd one, that, because we've always known that broadband, sort of, you know, this great wave that's coming in, and eventually IPTV will just be available, and that will be how we all get telly. But given that digital switchover is happening at a vast cost, and a lot of spectrum was being released, we felt as a publicly funded organisation that we absolutely had to be campaigning for some of that spectrum not to go to Richard Branson, not to go to Walmart,
and to go to local
whoever,
people.
But to go to local people.
All right, well, thank you very much for coming in, Mr. Shep, and it's been a pleasure to talk to you.
Thank you.
Before we move on to our next guest, Barb Drummond, we're going to hear a song from some singing pirates from Bristol, the Shantymen.
Bristol Shantymen. And we're doing a few open-air shanties, genuine sea songs from the period of the great days of sail.
So where do the Shantymen hang out normally, then?
Oh, in Bristol, anywhere around the Bristol area. Anyone who wants us to sing will be there.
Well, go on, then, get singing.
All right. Oh, there never was a ship so finer.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
As the old wildcat of the Swallowtail line.
Oh, clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Turn a hay rig, a jig, and a jaunting car.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
And I'm all on my knee.
Clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
For the old wildcat of the Swallowtail line.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
Was never a day behind a time.
Oh, clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Turn the hay rig, a jig, in a jaunting car.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
With Lizerly all on my knee.
Clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Oh, we're outward bound to New York town.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
Them Barry girls will dance around.
Oh, clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Turn the hay rig, a jig, in a jaunting car.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
With Lizerly all on my knee.
Clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
When we dump our freight on the West Street pier,
hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
I'll drink a gallon of Yankee beer.
Clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Turn a hay rig, a jig, in a jaunting car.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
With Lizerly all on my knee.
Clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Then we're homeward bound to Bristol town.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
Them hot Wells girls will dance up and down.
Oh, clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Turn a hay rig, a jig, in a jaunting car.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
With Lizerly all on my knee.
Clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Ah, when we get back to Bristol town.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
I'll stand your whiskers all around.
Oh, clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Turn a hay rig, a jig, in a jaunting car.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
With Lizerly all on my knee.
Clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Ah, when I get home from across the sea.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
It's Liza, will you marry me?
Clear away the track, let the bull shine run.
Turn a hay rig, a jig, in a jaunting car.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most done?
With Lizerly all on my knee. Clear away the track,
let the bull shine run.
Ah, there never was a ship so fine.
Hey-ya-ho, are you most.
How old is that song?
Oh, I'd say about 150 years, something like that. Late 19th century, we think, give or take 20 years.
So where do you get your songs from?
Well, a lot of them still in the oral tradition. A lot of them are on record. A lot of them are in books. And some of them are...
Handed down
or even written, composed nowadays.
Well, there we go. After a pint of grog or two, no doubt, that was a song from Bristol's very own Shantymen. Okay, so it's time for my next guest. I'd like to introduce a local historian, Barbara Drummond. Hello.
Hi.
Now, you've got a bit of an Australian accent. Tell me a little bit about sort of where you're from and how you wound up here.
I'm not really sure, but I've been a historian for about 6 years, and this is my 14th book.
Oh, wow, you're a hard worker.
Yeah.
Okay. So what sort of speciality subjects do you zero in on when you're writing your history?
I do mostly 18th century because that's when Britain went from being an agricultural society to a world leader. So it's a time, wars, famines, slavery, all the really interesting stuff, and it's parallels with the 20th century in America. So that there's lots of sort of, you know, having lived through part of the 20th century, I can sort of relate to the 18th century in Britain. So.
Okay, right. Now tell me a little bit about your latest book. It's Fine Ships and Gallant Sailors. And it's all about the Sydney Emden Battle, which took place on the 9th of November 1914. So tell me a little bit about where did this battle take place?
On the Cocos Keeling Islands. Mm-hmm. And I've been in touch with people out there. It was the main telegraph staging point between Australia and the rest of the world. Oh. And it was targeted by the Germans because the British had already destroyed the Germans' telecommunications. So basically, that was the only way that they knew where any of the ships were, so they were pretty much flying blind after that.
Okay, now you've described this as being a major turning point and a major battle. Possibly, I mean, in terms of Australia, I mean, it's significant as, say, the Battle of Jutland that took place somewhere off Denmark in 1915 for the UK. It's like the one major big sea battle.
Yeah, it was the only ship-to-ship battle that the Australian Navy happened, that we're involved in. But what drew me to the story was that the guy who wrote the journal, Edward Buncombe, was a shipwright with the British Navy, and he was just delivering the Sydney ship. And then when he was out in Australia and they were being all these celebrations for this new ship and the start of their Navy, the war broke out, and they went through the Pacific clearing out the Germans. And they were down to one raiding ship in the Pacific, which was paralysing shipping.
Okay.
The whole empire was pretty much held up because they were terrified to go to sea because of this one ship, because they couldn't find it. And so the Sydney was escorting the first fleet of the Anzacs to Gallipoli when they heard that there was a strange ship on the Cocos Islands. So they went off running battle, and that was the end of the Emden.
Right, okay. So this British man who was on board, he was the Bristol connection, is it?
His grandson transcribed his journal, so his grandson and most of his family live in Bristol.
Okay.
So that's the Bristol connection.
Ah, right, okay.
But he was born in Ireland.
He was born, right, okay.
So it's a book that touches on virtually every nationality, really.
Okay, how did you find, what was the experience of sort of reading through this journal? How personal is it?
It's incredibly ordinary, and that's what really touches you. He was really, when they got to South Africa, it was if they were there was loads of wattle thrown at the ship, and he'd never seen wattle before. And after the battle, they were going through sewers, and there was all these people running out of their tents and cheering them. And it's just these little details that are just, you know, there's a bit where they towed a submarine into an island where white men had never been seen. So it's a real sort of Captain Kirk moment, where you sort of think, you know, what did these local people think they were seeing? You know, and I there's a lot of it in the book that I didn't necessarily include it, but you're just sort of thinking, you know, what was happening here? And also because it's before the bloodshed of France, there's a lot of naivety about it. There's a lot of excitement about the battle, there's when the announcement came that the Emden had been destroyed, the British press was saying that they'd really miss it. There's a lot of romance has gone from the seas, and you think, I can't imagine anyone describing an enemy with that kind of.
Yeah.
You know, it's.
So coming from Australia, I mean, did you know about this when you, I mean, at all, this battle? I mean,
no.
It seems very significant. Did the public know about it much?
Well, I have yet to meet an Australian that's ever heard of it, and that's what really surprised me.
So what would have happened if that battle had been lost?
Well, it depends who you read. As far as I can tell, there was no intention to attack the Anzac convoy, but the British didn't know that. What you had were 23 ships loaded with men, and if a German raider had got in there, they could have been shooting wildly and sunk anything, and nobody could have stopped them.
Right.
And if that had happened, then Australia and New Zealand would have dropped out of the First World War.
Mm-hmm.
So all the colonies would have gone, and we'd probably all be speaking German.
Right. Tell us how we can get hold of this book that you've written. So
you can ask for it in any bookshop, or you can Google my name and find my website.
Okay, so the name is Barb Drummond, D-R-U-M-M-O-N-D. And the book is called Fine Ships and Gallant Sailors, The Sydney Emden Battle, the 9th of November 1914. And Barb, thank you very much for coming in and talking about it.
Thank you.
You're listening to dialectradio.co.uk, your local community radio run by volunteers. Log on to our website at dialectradio.co.uk to find out more.
Well, welcome now to Marla and Liv. Hello, Marla.
Hi there.
And hello, Liv.
Hi.
You are members of the Bristol University Action Group STAR, which is campaigning for equal rights for asylum seekers.
Yes, we are.
But in particular to do with education, I understand.
Yes, at the moment we've got a petition going trying to allow asylum seekers equal access to universities as refugees and British citizens as well. And we're trying to campaign so that they get to pay home fees rates instead of having to pay international fees, which can be up to £21,000 per year.
Oh, okay, so I mean, what sort of rights do asylum seekers have, you know, for a start off when, you know, when they arrive in the UK? What sort of rights do they get?
Very few rights. Well, I can list more easily what they don't have access to. They're denied the right to work in the UK. They're not allowed to take out student loans, and they're also not allowed to apply for grants or bursaries, so fairly restricted.
Okay, so if they are an asylum seeker here and they decide they want to, you know, learn something and gain, you know, some sort of entry into British education, they have to pay international fees as if they lived back home abroad from where
they
came from, right. So is that law?
That is technically the law, although the universities are all given their own discretion, so they are allowed to make the choice as to whether or not they charge home fees.
Right, okay.
And there are universities such as Manchester University, Edge Hill University, Liverpool Hope University, and Manchester Metropolitan that have all given asylum seekers the right to pay home fees, as well as the Scottish Government, who in 2007 decided to fund asylum seekers who had arrived under the age of 18 and had been residents in Scotland for 3 years or more.
Right, OK. So, Liv, tell me a little bit about how you first found out about the group STAR.
Well, I decided to join it because I wanted something extra to do at university. And we went to a conference in September, and two speakers opened the conference, who are actually coming to Bristol in 2 weeks' time, called John Attain and Cohen. John Attain is a young asylum seeker who come from the Congo and has now been granted refugee status and has finally been allowed to go to university.
Okay.
And Ko Ung is a refugee from Burma. And their stories were just so exceptional that we were just kind of overwhelmed, and has taken it on from there.
Okay, so what is happening? What is STAR organised or is organising beyond this? What are your next moves as a group?
Well, we've got an Ethics and Environmental Week coming up beginning on the 7th of March. Mm-hmm. And we are hoping to try and get as many people as possible to sign the petition around the university. So we're running all stalls during the sort of lunch breaks around campus. And we've also got this talk, which is going to be on Tuesday evening at 7:30 on the 9th of March at the... hopefully at the union, but there'll be more information about that.
Okay, can anyone go along?
Yes, absolutely anyone can go along. And for more information, to have a look at the Facebook group, which is called Equal Access! And to join that, to sign the petition as well.
Okay, brilliant. So anybody can sign that petition and
yeah, the more signatures, the better. That'd be incredible.
Okay, brilliant. Well, how else, is there any other way people can get involved? How many people on the petition have you got so far?
About, I'd say 250, but we're aiming for 1,000. So, as many people who are willing to sign it, please do.
And also, if you're not interested in the Facebook group, it would also be great if you could send a letter to STAR Bristol, Bristol Student Union, Queen's Road, BS8 1LN is the other way of getting involved.
Brilliant. Marla and Liv, thank you very much for coming in.
Thank you.
Our next feature is from Anthea Page. It's an interview with film producer David Pearson from Arturi Films about the documentary film Mugabe and the White African. It was recorded in a pub near Stroud, where Arturi Films are based. It was nominated for a BAFTA last week, a BAFTA I should say, but although in the last four failed to take the coveted prize, it was an excellent film in its own right.
I'm David Pearson from Arturi Films, and I'm producer of Mugabe and the White African. Mugabe and the White African is a very dramatic story about a white farmer called Mike Campbell, who takes the unprecedented steps of taking his president, Robert Mugabe, to court for racism. and it took great courage. And he had faced 8 years of threats and violence before he even decided to do that. But because of the kind of man he is, he decided that was the only honourable way forward. And he did this because they were really just wanting to steal his farm and give it to one of Mugabe's cronies. So he and his son-in-law, Ben Freeth, took this case to an international court where a panel of five black judges eventually found for him. So it's a remarkable insight into one man. It's a sort of David and Goliath story, I suppose. It's a story of courage, dignity, and people being prepared to stand up and be counted for their belief. And remarkably, in this film, you see the whole thing unfold in front of your very eyes.
Are you quite surprised by the impact the film's had on audiences generally?
I'm not that surprised. I suppose one of the reasons we took the project on was because we had faith that it would have an impact on people. When Andrew, one of the directors of the film, who I'd worked with before, came along, having spotted the story, said, you know, did I think it would make a good film? And I don't think we realised how much we were taking on when we started it.
I was amazed how much the camera managed to film undercover.
Yeah, a lot of people are surprised how it looks as a film, because I think it doesn't look as if it was, a lot of it was shot covertly. All the stuff in Zimbabwe was shot without permission to be there. The equipment had to be smuggled in, because it wasn't tiny equipment that you could hide. It was, you know, full-scale, large cameras and things. So it was all broken down into small pieces and smuggled in independently and separately, because they were always just one step ahead of the Zimbabwean security services and police, who obviously wouldn't have wanted them to be. The filming in the court, that was a remarkable piece of work by Lucy, the other director, who managed to persuade this international court to allow us to film in it, which is hardly ever seen. So it was a real exclusive, in a sense, to be in there seeing.
It was a huge fiasco in court, wasn't it?
It's really rare to see a court working like that, but it's even rarer to see what actually happened in this particular case, which is when the Zimbabwean delegation just decide to get up and walk out of the court proceedings because they don't like the way it's going, which is unprecedented in an international court setting, and it's highly unusual in any court and anywhere. And the fact that we're there to capture it, and it really shows you how the contempt with which the Zimbabwean government view the legal process, that they ordered their counsel to just leave.
The whole question is the white farmers. It doesn't come up in the news very often. Do you think that's why people have been quite shocked by the film?
Well, I've been following events in Zimbabwe for a long time, and in fact I made some films there myself a long time ago during the war for BBC, so I knew the country. And I knew that some of the coverage of the country, such as it's been, wasn't always completely encompassing and wouldn't, you know, really show all the things how they were. And also because of the press ban that's been there for over 10 years, you just haven't really seen any coverage anyway. But also that it's part of the received impression of that part of Africa that white farmers are bad, are all nasty white farmers, colonialists, and all the rest of it. In this case, these farmers bought this farm after Zimbabwe became a black majority rule country. They bought the farm and asked the government if the government would have any interest in the farm in the future, because if they were, they weren't going to buy it. The government gave them an assurance they wouldn't do anything with it. They spent 20 years building up the farm, paying off the money they borrowed to buy the farm, and then the government just came along and said it's ours. And the incredible thing is, at the moment, in the last week, the Zimbabwe government is now saying the same thing, pretty much, for white-owned businesses. And now, these are people who've made a commitment to a multiracial Zimbabwe, and I just find it extraordinary that the president there has effectively turned a country that was a net producer of food, it was the biggest producer of food in southern Africa 20-odd years ago, into a country that is now, a lot of its people are starving, because all these farms, when they take them, they don't farm them, they just strip, asset strip them, sell the machinery off, kill all the animals, take the barbed wire and flog it off, take the tin off the roofs of the houses and so on, and just leave it. So it's just depriving all the black African workers of any jobs and any homes and any food, and it's also depriving the country of any income.
Do you think this film will have any impact on the politicians?
We didn't set out to make a campaigning film. We set out to make a film that would put people in a position of experiencing what it's like to be in this position and with this family going through this incredible conflict and showing their courage, because I think it's a film about courage, really. But I think now it's being shown more widely. It is having an impact on politicians, and I hope it will raise the profile of the issue in Zimbabwe internationally. There's a misunderstanding worldwide that Morgan Tsvangirai entered into a so-called power-sharing government after the fiasco of the last two elections, which were basically fixed by Mugabe. There's a belief in the international, amongst international governments, that there's not a problem in Zimbabwe, and things are not getting better for a lot of people there. And if the governments of the Western world were able to pay a bit more attention, given that they do give a lot of aid to Zimbabwe, it would make a difference, because at the moment it's not really improving there for a lot of people, and certainly for the remaining whites, whatever the colonial history there, it would be, to me, blaming the remaining whites for everything that's happened in the past is a bit like saying to 20-year-old Germans today, you know, we still blame you for Nazism. They didn't do it. It was their, you know, it was their grandparents who were involved in that. And it's, you know, the white people who are living in Zimbabwe today are not responsible for everything that's happened 200 years ago.
So it's a tragic story, really, isn't it? Not only for the white farmer, but for the people they employ.
Most people think this is just a white issue, and of course it isn't, because most of these farms employ lots and lots of black farm workers. I mean, on this farm there were 500 farm workers and with their families. So that's an awful lot of people affected. It's like a whole village or something. In this case, the family had been run off the farm following the case, and farms, all the houses, of workers' houses, their houses have been burnt to the ground. They've got no work, and that's a real problem in a country like Zimbabwe at the moment, because there isn't enough food and there are no jobs. So effectively, it's believed it's in the region of about 2 million black African farm workers have lost their livelihoods in the last 10-20 years because of the so-called land redistribution program, which is held up as being a redistribution to poor blacks, but it's nothing of the kind, because you can see the list of people who are the new owners, and they're all the mates of Mugabe. I mean, you go down the list and it's all sort of generals and judges and girlfriends of judges. It's absolutely extraordinary. It's certainly not people who are deserving.
How many white farmers are left over there?
I think it's pretty much a handful now. I mean, it's been getting worse. I don't know the exact figures right now, but even in the last year, it's diminished significantly. I think there were about a year ago, I think there were about 50 or 60. It appears to be that the policy is hell-bent on just driving white farmers out of that country completely. And indeed, since they're now moving on to white businesses, that presumably is the intention, is to not have any white people in Zimbabwe, which to me is racist. I mean, you could hardly, you know, it would be appalling if someone said to a black American, you're not American because you're black and you don't belong here. That would be just as, to me, this is the same thing.
What's your next project? Any plans?
Next project. We mainly, as a company, RTRI Films, run by the other producer of this film, Lizzie Morgan Hemlock, and I mainly concentrate on fiction. So we've got about half a dozen fiction films that are all thrillers. Actually, it's quite interesting that this film, Mugabe and the White African, has been described as a thriller by quite a lot of people. And it's interesting, I think some people go to it imagining it's going to be a fictional film, but it isn't. But it does have those qualities of certain on the edge of your seat, you know, how is this going to all turn out, which is what makes it a gripping experience. And as a company, our motto is making stories that travel, because you can't survive making movies unless people want to go and see them in lots of countries. This film's going to be released in France in a couple of weeks' time, probably be shown in America and other places as well.
So just to remind the listeners, name of the film?
It's Mugabe and the White African.
And finally, what's your website?
The website is www.rtrifilms.com, or if you want to go to the film's website itself, it's www.mugabeandthewhiteafrican.com.
Thank you very much to Anthea Page for that feature. A short piece of music now. This is a track from an album by Ivor Gurney, a First World War poet and composer.
Thank you.
That was a piano piece by First World War poet and composer Ivor Gurney. He was born in Gloucester in 1891. Elderly people have a vast storehouse of knowledge, and Bristol is no exception. Dialect's Tony Gosling spoke to Pete Taplin, chair of Bristol's Old People Forum, which is based at the City Council.
My name's Pete Taplin, and I'm chair of the Bristol Older People's Forum, which is an organisation of between 2,500 and 3,000 members, which aims to improve the quality of life for older people.
What experience and what kind of things do you think elderly people have to offer nowadays?
They've got experience of life, haven't they? One of the things we were concerned about was until recently, older people were told what to do by youngsters out of college or, you know, with just a degree. And my first feeling was, when I became an older person, was I don't want a kid and somebody like my grandchildren telling me what's good for me. I'll tell them what's good for me and let them go and provide it or help provide it. And that's the way we're looking at it. When people like myself left school, people of our age or people of 60 were really old. But nowadays, people of 70 and 80 are running in marathons, and I speedily say I don't, but others do at that age. And we're looking for, as I say, to improve the quality of life. There are certain things that we're trying to do. We're trying to get the council, for example, to provide more public conveniences around the city rather than close them as they have been doing in the past. As you get older, you'll realise that access to public toilets is very necessary for people getting on. We've been involved in the linkage system at Bedminster and Southville, and another one at Lawrence Hill and Easton, where various activities are organised, hopefully by older people themselves, but with help from others, to give them, like I said, is improved quality of life and things that they can do rather than sit down at home waiting for the Grim Reaper. We send out new sheets every quarter. We do a new sheet every quarter. We have meetings in the council house, where we have three meetings a month, actually. One's the management committee, which is just a dozen of us. And of that dozen, three or four are from the BME community. We also have a full forum meeting in the council chamber, where 60, 70 or more people turn up every month to listen to speakers and ask questions. And we also have a campaign group, which organises such things as we hope to be able to achieve, like, as I say, in the toilets and things like that.
But is it just a talking shop, or have you actually got the power to twist the council's arm behind their back a little bit?
Twisting their arm is not the right word, but we're in full cooperation with the work that's going on, for example, in the linkage centres. We're consulted on an awful lot of matters. In fact, when the City Ground new supermarket was being mooted, we were one of the groups that were invited to comment. It turned out my goddaughter worked for the company who was doing the organisation, and I said, how did you get our name for consultation? And she said, well, we asked the City Council who we should talk to, and we were told you. So we are in their reckoning, I think, yeah.
So they listen, but the whole thing is sort of on trust then, is it really?
It's a bit different from the days when I was a shop steward in a trade union, that we haven't got sanctions that we could use. You know, in the old days, we used to be able to say, well, if you don't do it, our boys will walk out. But we've got nothing like that now. It's gentle persuasion, and hopefully persuading people like councillors and others that they'll be old themselves one day, and we're preparing the way for them.
So how long have you been doing this, and have you had any successes over the last few years?
Personally, I've been chair for about 4 years. I was a member a few years younger than that. Bill Nicholas, he was the chair before me. He's got an awful lot of experience. Successes? Well, like I say, we're involved in this linkage system, and if you ask people in Larks Hill and Easton and Bedminster and Southfield, you'll find some of them have got activities that they're participating in that they didn't do before.
Things like what sort of things do the linkage people do?
Dog walking groups, carpentry groups, and other groups like that, and meeting socially, befriending, helping people to get to the doctors and things like that. Meeting people, perhaps having a coffee morning. I think in one of the linkage centres they have coffee mornings. Certainly we went to see one in London before Bristol started, and they had coffee times, they had lunch breaks, they had a knitting circle for women, and all those sort of things that were helping to fund the organisation, if you like. The knitters sold what they knitted, and that went into the community chest.
Now, a lot of youngsters have little contact with their own grandparents, and often little contact with elderly people in their area. What do elderly people have to offer youngsters, do you think?
Well, it's a bit difficult nowadays, isn't it? Because you've got to have these CRB checks, but there was going to be contact with schools, perhaps, where elderly people could go in and help the youngsters. But I think today's politically correct system is working against that, because you can't just go in to a school and start talking to the children without being cleared by the police.
And that was Pete Taplin there, Chair of Bristol Old People's Forum. Time to hear the voice of Malcolm Greaves now. His honeyed tones will be reading this week's instalment, as usual, of Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street, a whimsical view of life in a Wiltshire village.
Hedge Trimmings by A.G. Street. Cheese. A gentleman called the other day and asked if he could have a few minutes' conversation with me about agricultural propaganda. "I've been reading some of your articles on farming matters lately," he said, when we had our pipes going nicely. "You know, you've got it all wrong. They're interesting, entertaining, and fairly logical, but you are trying to view the question from a purely economic standpoint." "Why not?" I asked, feeling a bit nettled, as this was the very thing upon which I had prided myself. "Isn't that the only sensible way to look at any business? Granted, for the individual farmer," he replied, "but it's all wrong from the national point of view. As I say, you have been thinking of the economic side only. That's all very well with regard to most industries, but agriculture is in a class by itself. It's fundamental. I mean, there always was agriculture. Presumably, Adam delved. The world cannot get along without farming. But the world got along quite nicely without a good many industries which we think are necessary today. Wireless, aircraft, railways, films, coal even. All these were unknown some few centuries ago. They are all comforts, luxuries, unnecessary." "Coal? Unnecessary?" I queried, thinking it was time that I got a word in. I did not exactly relish being talked down in my own house. "Absolutely," he said. "People lived their lives without it not so very long ago. You can be born, you can love, hate, fight, rear children, be sad, be happy, fall ill and die without coal. What more can you do with it?" "You could be rather cold," I ventured. "Quite, and very uncomfortable, but it's not essential. The world carried on all right without it years ago, but the world has never been able to carry on without farming, and it cannot do so today. Neither can a country, and that's what we're trying to do. Nationally, we have become so interested in our newer industries that we've forgotten the basic one. We have let our farming get into a terrible state. It's nearly dead. If something isn't altered, The whole countryside will be prairie and weeds in a few years. Result, still more unemployed, and all our other industries in a correspondingly worse condition. He paused for breath and glared at me as if it were all my fault. I'm inclined to agree with you, I said. In fact, I've pointed out most of it in my articles. But what's the remedy? It's no good bolstering up a thing if it's economically unsound. There you go again, he snorted. Economically unsound. Bah! You're like all these half-baked politicians. Why don't you grow up? Can't you see that agriculture is much too important a thing in the life of a community to be judged solely from a materialistic point of view? Don't you realise that all the really important things in life are economically unsound? Take friendship. Do you choose your friends from an economic standpoint? Man, it just can't be done. You wouldn't have any friends. What about love? When a young man falls in love with a girl, does he work out carefully whether it's an economic proposition? God help the girl if he does. Not he. If he wants the girl, he'll marry her in spite of all your economic theories. And neither his parents, nor the government, nor the League of Nations can stop him. You see, both love and friendship are far too important to be handled on economic lines. Again, when a son gets into a devil of a hole, financial or otherwise, does his father consider whether it's a paying proposition to help him out? Of course he doesn't. It's his son in a hole. That's all the argument the old man needs. And it's our countryside that's in a mess today. Look here, are you farming as well as you can farm? Good gracious, no, I said. Bad times are no brief for high farming. Rather, the reverse. Exactly. You're farming carefully, contenting yourself with a small output at the minimum of expense. In other words, you're marking time until a change in the economic situation warrants a return to intensive farming once again. That's about the size of it, I said. I could produce nearly double the present output from this farm. Well, why don't you? If you did so, you would employ a lot more labour, wouldn't you? Oh, yes, I answered, but it wouldn't pay. I can't afford to risk it. It wouldn't be an economic proposition. No, he said. It wouldn't. But it's a very important one, so we could afford to forget economics. Wouldn't it be better for the nation if it were made profitable for you and for all our farmers to farm as highly as possible and thus absorb a large proportion of our unemployed into your industry? Isn't it absolute insanity to support nearly 2 million people in idleness on the pretext that it is cheaper to pay them for doing nothing than to find them useful work to do? To say nothing of the increased home production and of the corresponding decrease in our bill for imported food. Oh, quite, I replied. But how are you going to persuade the town dweller to vote for it? He is the boss of the situation under democratic government. We aren't going to try, he answered. We're going to do it without even asking him. This is much too important to play according to the rules. And who is we? I asked ungrammatically. The government, he replied. We have decided that it is useless to apply modern economics to a fundamental thing like agriculture. We know that intensive farming is impossible in this country under present conditions, but we are immediately going to make it possible. We realise that none of our other industries can flourish without a healthy agriculture in the background. We also realise that to have 2 million unemployed is a shameful blot on our much vaunted modern civilisation. We shall say to you farmers that you must farm this Britain of ours to its maximum capacity, and so employ our idle countrymen. We shall say to the whole community that they must foot the bill to make this possible, whatever the cost. While such a course may be considered to be economically wrong, it is, in our opinion, morally right. Conversely, it might be argued that it is economically right, but most scandalously immoral. But we are going to stop arguing. We are going to do it. Anything is better than this present policy of drift. At this moment, my telephone rang. Excuse me, I said, as I reached out of bed and switched off my alarm clock, which goes off every morning at 4:45. Whenever I eat cheese for supper, I dream silly things like this.
Thank you very much to Michael Greaves for that excellent reading of Headstrimmings. Now it's time to hand over to Trevor Carter. The Bard of Windmill Hill, he is here with an intellectual and provocative poem. Hello.
Oh, hi, John. Hi. This is called Flags.
Okay.
Flags, and it was written in Barcelona a little while ago, and there were flags all over the place. And so I was thinking about what's the significance of flags. This is it, flags. Flags, the rags of nationalism, incite the senses into schism. Nationhood's paternalism flutter in the breeze. Red, the flags of socialism. Blue denotes conservatism. White, the flags of pacifism, emanate unease. Totem points of tribalism, Green's environmentalism, each ignoring criticism, recruiting new trainees. Identifying heroism in the face of terrorism helps to stifle cynicism, deterring escapees. People bow to symbolism, get off on their jingoism, lose the lights of liberalism, see them on their knees, fearing fundamentalism's gruesome exhibitionism, threatening materialism with evacuees. War spawns forms of totalism, sharp the edges of its prism, humanity's determinism, behold its amputees. There are no flags for fatalism, or the rugged realms of realism. Choose your own idealism, fly the flag you please. From fragments of fraternalism, aspects of romanticism, alternatives to nihilism, fluttering in the breeze.
And thank you very much to Trevor Carter there.
Thank you, John. Thank you.
Oh, would you like to give a little plug for any particular book in particular?
I've got the remarkable Ash Dickinson at Between the Lines on the 5th of March. So it'll be, that'll be Circles Bookshop, Bookshop Cafe. Tickets are available from Circles on North Street, Bedminster.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can phone me for reservations or details on 0117 966 5514. So a great night's entertainment is guaranteed for only £4.
Brilliant.
Remarkable international superstar poet. And also a wonderful comedian.
He has all sorts
of accolades to his name. So
brilliant. And his name is once again?
His name is Ash Dickinson. You can look him up if you wanna. He's got stuff, you know, on the web if you want to get a flavour of what he does.
Brilliant. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Time once again for our very own man in black, it's Mr. Jeff Sparks with What's On in Bristol. Hello.
Hello, thank you, John. Good evening. This is your What's On guide from Dialect Radio. Starting with Friday, 5th of March, and the Hamsters will be performing at the Tunnels at Bristol and Exeter Mews in Bristol. Doors open at 7:30 p.m. and tickets are £11 in advance and £13 on the door. Also on 5th of March, the daughter of June Carter Cash and stepdaughter of Johnny Cash, Carlene Carter, we'll be performing at the Thunderbolt in Bath Road, Bristol. Doors open at 5 p.m. and tickets are £18 in advance. On to Song of the Week, and I feature Johnny Cash. This is from the album At San Quentin, and this is the song Peace in the Valley, which features some very special guests.
Just before we ask the Statler brothers to come back out, we'd like to ask the Carter family and Carl to help us out on a fine spiritual that we've got a lot of requests to do. Peace in the Valley. Well, I'm tired and so weary, but I must go along till the Lord comes and calls me away, oh yes. And the morning's so bright, and the lamb is the light, and the night is as black as the sea, oh yes. there'll be peace in the valley for me, dear Lord, I pray. There will be peace in the valley for me. Well, the bear will be gentle, and the wolf will be tamed, and the lion shall lay down by the lamb, oh yes, and the beast from the wild will be led by a child. And I'll be changed from this creature that I am, oh yes. There will be peace in the valley for me, dear Lord, I pray. There will be peace in the valley for me.
That was Johnny Cash with Peace in the Valley from the album At San Quentin. It is worth noting that American Six, Ain't No Grave, which is the sixth and final instalment of the American Recordings album series, has just been released. For more information, you can check out www.johnnycash.com. Moving on to Saturday, 6th of March, the Blue Aeroplanes will be performing with support from Daddy Longlegs and also Archimedes at the Thunderbolt in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £10 in advance and £12 on the door. Also on 6th of March, the tribute group Guns N' Roses will be performing at the Fleece in Bristol. Doors open at 8 p.m. and tickets are £9 in advance. Into Sunday, 7th of March, Hadouken will be performing with support from This City and also Unicorn Kid at the Thekla in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £12.50 in advance. Finally, on Monday, 8th of March, The Stranglers will be performing at the O2 Academy in Bristol. Doors open at 7 p.m. and tickets are £23.50 in advance. That's all from me. Thanks for listening and have a great week. Take care and goodbye.
Just as a neat connection there, The Stranglers did an album called The Men in Black themselves, which in 1982 is the most expensive album ever made. Well, that's the end of this week's show. That's all we've got time for. Thank you very much to our studio guests, which are Phil Shep, Barb Drummond and Marla and Liv. Thank you to Malcolm Grease for his talent in reading hedge trimmings by A.G. Street. And we also heard music by composers Ivor Gurney, a First World War poet and composer. And also, we heard the Shantymen of Bristol doing a bit of pirate singing. The features were by Anthony Page and Tony Gosling, and the what's on was by Jeff Sparks. And thank you to Trevor Carter, as ever, the Bard of Windmill Hill and Dialect Radio. Studio engineers were Johnny Royden and Andy Gordon, and the producer was Anthony Page. It's goodbye from me, John Peters Coleman. Take care. You can subscribe to our RSS feed and download our podcasts from dialectradio.co.uk.